Good morning. Today is March 20th, 2024. Well, we've been doing this for a while. The Daily Stoic Review. Decided to record them. This is our first episode we're offering to you. Give it a listen. If it puts you to sleep, thank me. Found it interesting, thank me. If you ignore it, well, thank you very much. And we hope you enjoy it. Today's is a pretty interesting one. It went way too long. Might bore you. But either way, we offer it for your review, criticism, if you will. Ciao, ciao. Enjoy. Three, two, one, and we're live.
Wow. Bless up yourself, Rocco.
Bless up.
So we're drinking French press this morning because we decided to give up our plastic coffee makers. That never quite made sense to me that you'd be putting boiling hot water through plastic and that's good for you.
Even though the government says it's safe.
Exactly. But this is a quality brand, Le Creuset coffee, French press, and it's in our signature red theme color, which is very comforting and healing. You know what else is comforting and healing? Stoicism. So today's reading, March 20th. This is 2024. Ready and at home. I may wish to be free from torture, but if the time comes for me to endure it, I'll wish to bear it courageously with bravery and honor. Wouldn't I prefer not to fall into war? But if it does befall me, I'll wish to carry nobly the wounds, starvation, and other necessities of war. Neither am I so crazy as to desire illness, but if I must suffer illness, I'll wish to do nothing rash or dishonorable. The point is not to wish for these adversities, but for the virtue that makes these adversities bearable. And this is from Seneca, Moral Letters 67.4. So Ryan Holiday's take on this is President James Garfield was a great man, raised in humble circumstances, self-educated, and eventually a Civil War hero, whose presidency was cut short by an assassin's bullet. In his brief time in office, he faced a bitterly divided country as well as a bitterly and internally divided Republican Party. During one fight, which challenged the very authority of his office, he stood firm, telling an advisor, "Of course I deprecate war, but if it is brought to my door, the bringer will find me at home." Okay. That's what Seneca is saying here. We'd be crazy to want to face difficulty in life, but we'd be equally crazy to pretend that it isn't going to happen, which is why when it knocks on our door, as it very well may this morning, let's make sure that we're prepared to answer. Not the way we are when a surprise visitor comes late at night, but the way we are when we're waiting for an important guest, dressed in the right headspace and ready to go. So Rocco, ready and at home.
Yeah, I kind of zoned out when you read the actual quote. Can you try the quote again?
Sure. I may wish to be free from torture, but if the time comes for me to endure it, I'll wish to bear it courageously with bravery and honor. Wouldn't I prefer not to fall into war? But if war does befall me, I'll wish to carry nobly the wounds, starvation, and other necessities of war. So neither am I so crazy as to desire illness, but if I must suffer illness, I'll wish to do nothing rash or dishonorable. The point is not to wish for these adversities, but for the virtue that makes the adversities bearable.
I think you've been having too much milk with that little going on. Well, I got it now. I plugged in. I think maybe I kind of zoned out of that because it was just obvious to me, maybe. I don't know. Sometimes things like that happen when I know something and it's like, yeah, okay, see you later. I don't clue in anymore. But after you reread it again and I was kind of deliberately listening, I came to the, you know, it's funny because a lot of times the driving force in my essence appears to always show itself, and it's, yeah, the I word is going to come in again. Integrity, right? I mean, integrity is a pretty tricky concept to convey to people, perhaps who don't have any, but even someone who is well familiar with the term doesn't necessarily always understand the various facets which may call on one's integrity. And, you know, got to make this personal now because that was the first thing that came to my mind in kind of embracing the wisdom there. Like there's absolutely no joy in opening and exposing and creating a contentious environment when after my mom passed and went through a pretty rough end landing to, you know, that sunset. I think she was pretty much vacant for the last few years of that while people just prodded her around and kept her shell alive. This may actually do some damage, just reflecting on it now, this may actually do some damage to the soul which was occupying it. Maybe it gets trapped. It's almost like it might be in a purgatory until it's allowed to release, you know, exit the shell completely. So what am I saying here? I'm saying I created this situation back in 2015, I think it was, where I proposed a plan to kind of pave a nice clean path to a sunset without a lot of the you know, challenges that come in when you encounter some health degrading and mobility degrading and things like this. My dad and I come up with this plan to break him out of his assisted care living, not on a permanent basis, because he really enjoyed the interactions with the various people that also inhabited it. Now, look, it was like you're walking into a, you know, a prison of sorts, you know, an insane asylum or something. Everyone's just sitting around in their walkers or this or that. When you walk into the place in the social areas, everyone's looking at you, you know, it's like you walked into a zoo and a bunch of monkeys just kind of staring at you saying, hey, you look
different.
Yeah, it
was one fancy zoo and I thought it was very dignified and quite luxurious. And the interesting thing I found about your father there, because I remember your parents, both parents or even just your dad, it was like if someone, they wouldn't go out for fear that they would be missing if somebody popped in to visit. And they always wanted a visit and were very happy to receive. So that time when you had called him and said that we were going to come over and visit, and he was quiet there for a bit. And then he said, do you think you can come in an hour or so? Because I'm going down for a bingo. And that to me just showed actual real growth with him, because normally they wouldn't have any of their own thing going on. Their top priority was their kids. So the idea that he was enjoying the bingo and can you come after bingo made me feel like he was driving his own bus and living his life.
Excellent. Excellent observation. And good to bring that back up, because I think that happened a couple times, even when I was passing through and stuff, and he had some other distractives in the day. So yeah, he was not necessarily a growth per se, but he was definitely acclimating to being in a, you know, a more collaborative sunsetting environment. And, you know, I did do the bingo with him a couple times, and it was painful, but my dad wasn't in, he was doing that to be social, but also because he enjoys numbers and things like that, and little puzzles and little intricate, you know, thought things. He likes it. It always occupied his time. He'd be counting lotto numbers or calculating which numbers came out and so forth. He definitely was, if he would have been, you know, if he would have been acclimated to the country and the language a lot more, I think he might have been really receptive to some of the, you know, my career choice and technology. He might have even embraced it in a more enthusiastic manner, as opposed to just these little wicked devices that just steal your time. And maybe it's a good thing he didn't get into that, because it can be a little bit of a rabbit hole of you know, kind of closing up your world, because you're physically, you know, you're not moving and stuff. Regardless, I mean, it is what it is. So going back to the relationship to you, nobody chooses to create a situation that they're going to have to painfully make their way through. And our decision to completely hijack our life from a place where we had really, it was actually the most settled house we'd been in over the, what year? I guess it would be in the neighborhood of 25 years over that period, lifespan or period of time together. That was probably the most kind of settled in house. We had everything fixed. It wasn't a big house, but it was definitely utilized. And some of the rentals we had made were really made it feel like a home. Everyone that came always, you know, kind of commented on how it just felt really comfortable. We had a really nice kind of family kitchen with a big bar that was in the center, that was our kitchen table and the dining room and whatever, living room and stuff. We had the little den with the fireplace off the kitchen. So it was actually a quite ideal family home. And, you know, the problem that came up and, you know, guys have this, well, I do, I'm not sure, maybe other guys can comment, but guys have this kind of essence to them when something is presented in the terms of a problem, you know, we go into MacGyver mode and try and resolve it, untangle, get to the end, figure it out, you know, contribute in that manner. Well, maybe not all guys, but I certainly have that. And there were a lot of challenges with my dad's situation there around 2014, over a few months, and then in 2015 sometime we ended up taking that step. But you know, he was there was some stresses, external stresses, talking about, you know, meeting pension income on my dad was not paying it was not covering the expenses for him to be in assisted living, which was a at the time was maybe three plus thousand a month, plus, you know, whatever incidentals might have gone into there. And, you know, although he had tons of capital that he'd accumulated, he had his house and various things going on, cash or whatever, he has a house overseas and stuff, but somehow this cash flow became an obstacle to him having a stress-free kind of sunset. It was brought up to him, and it wasn't brought up to him in a manner to to shock and awe him. It was brought up to him and just as a casual conversation. You know, after a while, it's your father, you know, you kind of run out of conversation to make. Not that you run out, but depends on the relationship. I never did. I always found a fresh angle to just kind of poke his curiosity and things, and we discuss it, even if it was just a few minutes to talk about, you know, tell me about what it was like to ride a motorcycle when you were in the military. And, you know, he was stationed to do these, you know, take these important people, ranked up from him, obviously, take these people and, you know, from wherever he was, Padua, take him to Milan or whatever transportation was going on. And I think he did that for a little period of time. I don't know exactly how long. And he kind of talked to me about that experience and how he really loved it. He really enjoyed that responsibility where someone said, we got to get this guy to this base or something like that. It wasn't wartime. It was serving. And he really enjoyed being able to serve the other person. And even in his days at home, somebody came with a small problem, piece of equipment, my lawnmower doesn't work. Many lawnmowers he's...
Must be a man thing. You're right. Men like problems and they see a way to help by solving the problem. And women often will bring a problem to a man. When they bring a problem to a man, they are asking for help to fix it. But when they're just talking about a problem, they just want an ear. They don't need a solution. They often figure out the solution. So when men come out with a solution, women often will be upset because really their need is not a solution. Their need is just hear me. I need some attention here. I need to download here. And because I don't think men have that same need, it's very difficult for a man to understand that. I think it's a nature thing, but it also reflects on the environmental, the nurture thing. It's just like, depending on where you've grown up and what your culture is, there's certain things that you're willing to do and not do or open to doing.
Certainly. You definitely opened up that topic here. Hopefully I won't forget my train going forward, but that's a good topic because it actually mirrors what's happening in society today. They don't really talk about it now, but I think months ago, it's like, what is a woman? These conversations they were talking about and society today, society today has this direction it's in, which is somewhat lost, where it's kind of blurring the lines and, you know, equality is being paralleled with equity and does that make sense? Equity, equality.
It's different. Equality is giving everybody the same. Equity is giving everybody, fulfilling everyone's need based on their needs.
Right. Actually, that's so it is a good comparison. So we're going from, you know, using discretion, meaning this person's diabetic, please do not, they're very thirsty. This person's a diabetic, please don't give them water. I mean, don't give them orange juice, right? Because that's going to spike, cause insulin. And ultimately, it's not the right refreshing beverage for someone who's thirsty and diabetic. And then there's somebody who's totally not diabetic, let's say, and needs a drink. And maybe some, you know, a fresh coconut water would be much more appreciated for them. It refreshes them, gives them a bit of energy and so forth. But the diabetic, that's actually damaging for them. It causes a whole metabolic, you know, pathway changes because sugar comes in and insulin. And somebody who's diabetic has got problems metabolizing the glucose versus non-glucose. Anyway, that gets a bit complicated for now. So you need to give what's appropriate not necessarily equal, right? So you give that coconut water to both people, it's very equal. But one person now has gone into a weird hyper glucose, and then with the insulin rushing in, then it gives you a drop, right? Whereas the other person is very, you know, has never abused, let's say, glucose. This is just a very, you know, they only have a couple, 20, 30 grams of sugar a day, and it's fine. They can just blow that off. It's not a big deal. So one person seems seemingly unaffected by this That's jump right. in glucose, and the other person is now flat on the couch, like, you know, like your mother needing a short little nap
it to recover. Depends on their metabolic state, so you can't give
exactly.
them both the same thing.
So what is a woman? And we're blurring those lines, and we're almost trying to say, well, let's give them both diluted coconut water. So one person gets gypped because they got this semi-bland thing, and the other person still gets a glucose hit. So you basically messed with both people's metabolism on an equal basis, equally. So yeah. you've tried to be fair, and you've equally screwed them both. And I think that whole discussion about what is a woman and the blurring of lines is pretty much the problem with trying to define being fair, being equal, equity, all of this stuff. These are words, but there is a woman, there is a person with diabetes, there is a man, there is a man who's metabolically healthy. We don't treat them the same. But how about everything else? Women are very different. Men are very different. We're exactly the same. 99.9% of our DNA and everything else is exactly the same. However, we're very different. Hey, two men aren't the same. So you got to figure a man and a woman must be quite different. Women are more right-brained. You need the emotion to be able to have this life come out of your body, which is completely, it's just somewhat revolting to experience. And I've experienced it in a laboratory environment of an operating room more times than anyone should. And the woman goes through this complete transformation of their body to be able to pass a bowling ball out. It's like, it's okay, maybe just a 5-pin bowling ball, but still it's a freaking bowling ball. I couldn't imagine, you know, sometimes I have a turd that's a bit larger and it's like, good Lord, what a stretch that was. Imagine how a woman goes through, and then they go through this, and yourself who went through, you know, being in the hospital because of the emergency state of the first time this thing went down. You go through like this torturous period. A man would never have a second child after just in what a man's sensibility. It's like, that's not some pain I need to embrace for another time. And a woman just forgets about it after a few months. And it's like,
be quite resilient in that.
Yeah, definitely. Well, it's not about being resilient. I think that's nature makes a woman right-brained. Emotion is the reason they are able to keep the insane husband, within the family, because their emotions say, listen, the guy is not doing this against me. I mean, barring violence to a degree. This guy is doing what he does best. He's trying to fix shit and go forward, you know? And he's not looking typically about making sure everybody feels good. You know, man, just figure a man in a battling war, on the ground war, you know, troops and stuff like that. Hey, are you okay, son? Yeah, you feel, oh, you really still feel bad about that guy you killed over there, or this, that, or your partner dying and stuff? That's not going to work. It's going to have a bunch of men who just basically evaporate. The war just ends quick. Slaughter happens, and that's it, because man doesn't work with emotions. Emotions are just this extra thing that I guess we need to understand sympathies. And, you know, yes,
I do love this little turd that came out of my wife's body after a while. It starts reacting and starts, you know, interacting with me a little bit. It, you know, bats his eyes, just like you can fall in love or you become attached to a dog. You can definitely become attached to something that you contributed in creating, right? But not logically. Logically, a man's going, what the hell did I get myself into here? This is a disaster. I never, you know, our logic says, no, we must propagate. So we have propagate. We procreate. I'm not sure what that word is.
Yeah, it's procreate.
Procreate. We must reproduce. It's almost in our DNA. It's a necessary evil. Reproduce. Have some offspring to help you go on the hunt so that you can, you know, thrive as a tribe. And a woman is there to protect the child from this brutal experience until, of course, they reach puberty. And then they discover that, you know, if it's a boy, I mean, they discover that they need to now hang with the dad, that dad's their, you know,
their role model,
that's their role. Once this is now when they come of age. What does that mean? You know, coming of age, it means now you get to start emulating and practice the skills to become where you came from, you know.
Well, there's a lot of talk out there about the effects of children being raised in single parent homes by their mothers. Actually, not children, boys especially. And where is the masculine influence in their life? And if you think about it, the way women are, if you look at some families where there's an addiction issue, like alcohol, if you look at a family where the father is an alcoholic or a functioning alcoholic, the women can manage to keep things together, and they do it because at the end of the day, you throw out the man, you're throwing out the income, and your income, a woman's income, isn't, you know, the time invested outside of the home in order to equalize the income for a woman. It's just not feasible in raising a family. So, however, when you see the reverse, a family where the mother is an alcoholic and the father has to keep it all together, it's not the same effect. There's something about women in them that they are looking out for their kids, and that means creating as stable a home as possible. And so with the onset of feminism and all of that, where women will feel like, heck, I can still get his income and throw him out and move on, and they introduce new men that often we're hearing now molest their children, and there's a lot of problems out there. And it just takes me back to that crazy Star Trek episode of the Borgs, and it just seemed so unbelievable that there is a Borg race that wants to make everybody the same and you will be assimilated. And it just seemed like nonsense, and that's not good, or will it ever happen? And now in 2024, we're finding that you can't even define a woman anymore. Are we getting closer to being Borgs?
Yeah, this is exactly what you actually, that's an interesting parallel you've made there. I you know, as much as I love Star Trek, I had trouble with focus on it. I was more interested in the personal dynamics and the intrigue that Shatner and I guess all the subsequent leads in that on all those series. I was more intrigued with their approaches and the reactions to things that happened. Storyline was always problematic with me because it all seemed somewhat insane. But that's a good point, and that is a very good point. If one were to analogize where society has taken us, in particular as far as the sexes and even being subjugated, you know, being you know, generally equal plebeians, is exactly where we're going. You know, it's quite frightening to many ways to ponder that too deeply. I think keeping your senses about you and watching what's going on in society from outside gives you a vantage point that allows you to criticize what's happening, as opposed to when you're in it, it becomes a defensive criticism, right? I'm taking this side, whatever it may be in that argument. You're taking this side mostly because of ego, because you're already here. It's harder to do something else at this point, you know, and things like that. So your ego prevents you from really seeing an unbiased landscape. Whereas if you step out of it a little bit, I'm not participating. I'm not watching mainstream media. I don't identify with all of these things, and avoiding getting sucked into the lures to become, assimilated, if you will. You can see it. You can see what's happening with a perspective that allows you to criticize it in order to, critical thinking in order to see a very distilled decision before you. And when you're in it, you're always clouded with, here's another way to look at it. You know, I remember in the day when I was younger, you know, approaching owning a car type of age, 16, 17, 18 years old. And one guy at high school, Lenny, I can't remember his last name, but he was like the kind of quiet, very cool, but quiet. And he got along, all the cool kids he was in that kind of a cool kid crowd. And I kind of passed through different crowds. Everyone was kind of accepting of me, and then they would go into areas that would become too mindless, and I'd kind of just walk away and move off to the punk rock crew, I don't know what you'd call them today, but they were the people that the normal crew was almost afraid to interact with because they're very different. So taking that view from outside, not being enrolled, the point I was making about that, sorry, Lenny, his father, for some reason, I believe they're in construction trade. So I think he might've been only like 17 because it was in high school, and maybe it was even 16. I don't know. But he all of a sudden got a blue Camaro IROC. What do you call those? What was the fancy?
The one? Z28.
The Z28, that's right. So he got the Z28, right? And brand new, like this got to be what, 81, 82, 83. I'd love to find one of these pictures. Maybe I'll try and attach something, but of a car that looks like that. And look, I wasn't a Camaro person. Why wasn't I a Camaro person? Take a guess.
Envy?
No, it wasn't that.
You couldn't identify with those hardcore types with those? Because I remember Sergio Dezen used to come to high school. He had a gold Z28. I didn't even see gold out there. He was the only one I saw like that.
Okay, well, if you... It's not about me per se. It's about my exposure. And just like I was saying, once you're inside the box, you become biased. Well, in 1969, my brother lobbied for a new car. He brought my dad to Yorkdale, across from Yorkdale. I think it was called Plaza Pontiac. Is it Pontiac? Yeah. Whatever. And he brought my dad to that showroom dealership. And of course, on a big elevated platform, there was the white Trans Am.
Oh, dear. That's right. Your brother had a Trans Am in the...
He bought a 19... someone's going to have to correct me on this. I'll try to find some pictures and post that too. But he bought he ended up lobbying my dad to buy him a car or to help him because he was just kind of barely working at that time. And I think he might have had 25% of the price. I think it might have even been just like 5,000. That could be wrong. I don't know. But He had a portion of the money and he lobbied my dad to back him to buy this car. And so he bought the, I think it was 1970 Trans Am. It was white with the blue stripe and it had, you know, the flares thing. It had the scoop in the back. And it was, I think it was the next first year of a new generation in the body style. Because just before that, the Camaro on the and the Firebird, yeah, Firebird Trans Am, they looked very similar. They looked like a, you know, a bit smaller GTO type of a car. It just looked like one of the same cars. But then for some reason, they both kind of opened up that new generation. And it was like, wow, this is an amazing vehicle. And then he, of course, he upped the transmission, put a Hurst shifter in it. He upped the wheels. He put these really big wheels in the back. And oh, he was, it was all about the Trans Am.
Those were awesome cars. I think those cars are so pivotal. When you think of those cars, you think of the 70s and the 80s. And then they just fizzled out in the 90s.
So,
no one wanted them anymore. People were more into the Honda, Honda Preludes, those types of cars. Those
Toyota. Well, of course, the not wanting them, it might be a little, you know, simplistic. I think what happened is a lot more efficient and cost efficient vehicles started coming in from Japan, I guess. And, you know, of course, some people started getting them and their value is value. And some of those cars look pretty cool, too. But and that was the end of the American dream time, probably in the, you know,
late 80s, the American dream. Right. That muscle car and all of that whole thing about that American dream sort of, if you think about it now, retrospectively, that's when it started to fizzle out. You let the Japanese cars in, and then before you know it, everything went offshore and immigration came here with no jobs. All the jobs are lower paying or very high skilled, high paying. Some average person couldn't go out and get a job and get their dad to back them for a car anymore today.
Well, a lot of things changed, I guess. You know, I think women's lib was also starting to creep into the popular culture. And just to close off that thing, and I didn't necessarily. Oh, I thought it was an awesome car. It looked fantastic. But why didn't you get a Firebird? Why didn't you get a Trans Am?
Yeah.
And that was always my angle on that. And why? Well, because my brother had it, and I have fond memories of him taking me to Wasega with that a couple of times. And, you know, his cool little thing he'd do is once in a while we'd go out together and he'd stop in at KFC and he'd get one of these, I think they were called a snack pack then or something. And it was like three pieces of chicken and fries and stuff. And we both would kind of, he'd pick it up, we'd go into his Trans Am and we'd, you know, share that little meal. And it was fantastic. And you know, in that car, especially back then, I couldn't even see over the front dash. All I can see is his shifting and his legs working, and it just seemed like he was such a gangster, man, such a guy, man. It was incredible. It was incredible what something like having the freedom of mobility can deliver to a man, right? That's the guy who solves problems. And I try and bring this back to the question. Okay, so, the best about this is right around that same time, Lenny got his Camaro. But my other buddy, who also I realized after later on at some point, was also had parents in the construction field. So I guess they were like, got to write some stuff off. Attitude on this, and it's like, what the hell, just buy the kid a car and can write it off. I need an expense on my business, whatever the case may be. Well, there was Joe Fuoco. I should look that guy up. It's funny because he always had remember when Wham came out?
Oh yeah.
He was like, he looked like that boy George.
Michael.
He
had
George Michael. Right. He had that kind of that same smile he had George Michael had. I think pretty much everything, they just look so much the same, except I'm pretty sure Joe Fuoco wasn't gay. Not to say that
it
George Michael is.
It was disappointing when I found out that George Michael was gay. I thought he was such a
Well, disappointing. It was, I don't really idolize people. But anyway, so Joe Fuoco was pretty cool because as soon as, you know, I caught on that he had a Trans Am, And it was a big ass one at the time, a 6.6 liter. Like 6.6 was the number. And his was gold and had the big chicken on the hood and everything, right? So, you know, he was my buddy after that. It was like he'd always come look for me because I'd always, dude, this car is freaking amazing. Probably dude wasn't the term we used, but so we'd go driving at lunch. He'd take pick me up and we'd go out to wherever, go visit other high schools. It was kind of funny to go to Madonna or
That was the thing. Jeffries. You hopped into the car and you went to some other neighboring high schools as the day ended or some. I never did that. But some people skipped the last period to go drive to some other school and pull up in the parking lot with a hot muscle car and watch everyone get out of school and the other school. And it's like, we're from this school. And yeah, it was interesting.
Yeah. So we did that a lot and it was kind of cool because in the cold times, in the winter times, he had a pretty good sound system in it as well. I don't know, not compared to what you get today with a stock, but it was definitely making sounds. And, you could hear from outside and we'd be driving around cause he was not, we didn't. And funny enough, he never really showed me what it does. Like as far as top end and things like that, it wasn't about that back then too much. I mean, if you were going to do that, it was to kind of race another car, not really just to go fast. And
yeah, the mods weren't that obvious. If they did it, you're right. It was for racing and it would be engine things that wasn't that obvious.
Yeah, but we would cruise at a very regular kind of road. I think he just wanted people to make sure they saw him. Well, he got a pretty hot car. And in the wintertime, right, he after the car warmed up, per se, he'd crank that heat blowing like serious heat. And we drive with the windows down. And he goes, the heat's free. And he'd have that smile, that George Michael smile. He'd look over to me and he'd go, the heat's free. Let's open the windows.
And you know what? That's what I admire about the Italians in the way that they have a certain pride. So they want to give their kids, because obviously none of the kids can afford these cars on their own. So their fathers bought them, you know, in high school, who's got the money to buy a car? But I thought it was pretty awesome that the parents had that pride. It's like, yeah, I work hard. I want my kid to have a hot car. And I don't know what Vaughan Road was like, but Woodbridge High School was a very interesting dynamic because they had the big parking lot and the Italian kids all showed up with their hot cars and their mungie cakes because it was basically two races. It was Italian and then it was WASP or mungie cake. And they'd show up with some beat up cars or on the bus, but the Italian kids pretty much had access to vehicles and some of them drove with some pretty, pretty nice cars. And even the teachers used to comment and say, I don't understand how these Italian kids show up at school with Corvettes. And
yeah, we didn't have any Corvettes. Maybe we did. I don't know. Woodbridge definitely had a lot more people in construction because they probably built the neighborhood and got a pretty decent deal back in the day to kind of pick one up, maybe even to pay off. If you were working in there, they give you a good chunk on the price. That way you don't claim any income and you get it for cheaper. So everybody kind of wins in that situation. And so I'm pretty sure that there were a lot of that. That was almost kind of a fertilizer for that type of improper spoiling. Let's just leave it at that.
It was like a pissing match, I think, amongst the immigrants to show, look what I got.
Because
you got Stephanie. I'll never forget my hairdresser, Stephanie Galizia. Overweight. Her nickname was Baby Beef. She was fat her whole life. But her father, when she was 16, bought her a silver Corvette. She was coming to school in a silver Corvette. And then another guy, remember, Mimo Retta, he showed up. He had a metallic orange Corvette. So the other guys were like, you got the orange car. They were making fun of it because they, that's a girl color or that's not a cool color to have an orange Corvette. But you're looking back on it, and his answer was, why? What's wrong with orange? And when you think about it, I don't know, 16, 17, going to high school in a Corvette, I'll take any color.
Well, that color was actually quite nice. And maybe he liked it and he was man enough or masculine enough that it didn't feel like he was dry.
I don't think he picked it. I think
that could be it.
I think his father bought it. Oh, well, one more, sorry. Jimmy Dezen. He wasn't even 16 with a license yet, and his dad already had a Corvette in the garage for him for when he got his license. And what happens is they take it out for a boot right at Highway 7 in Martin Grove, just past Martin Grove towards Kipling there, where you can kind of see the St. Peter's Ravine and field in the background. He's there with some guy, some other, I think the last name was Muscarin. And they're 16 years old, no driver's license, does a U-turn on Highway 7, crashes the car. So the other guy, the passenger, Muscadin, passed away, died in that car accident.
Dear.
I remember hearing about it. It was a big deal. I don't know how they got out of it. They already had a lot of money there. I don't know how an unlicensed person driving a vehicle crashes it and someone dies, how that got worked out. But if you want to go six steps to Kevin Bacon, when we bought this cottage, this place here,
346. 6 degrees of separation?
Yeah.
The
executor of the estate was Tiberio Muscarin.
7 degrees of separation.
And his son was the one that died in that car accident back then. And to see that on our documentation, that last name handling this estate sale here of this place brought me back to that thought there.
Sure.
So these vehicles were a big deal for the.
It was a big part of coming of age, you know. I mean, it wasn't to be under. Yeah, you know, you get to a certain point, and if the guy does not get a car before he's like, you know, 20 or something, there's something wrong, I guess, right? I mean, my first car, I don't remember how old I was. I might have been like 19, 18, because we had moved out of the inner city there, or the city proper into a suburb north. And I think my brother was involved instrumentally. And I think it's because he realized that there's an importance in having your vehicle. Mind you, I did get a 200cc Vespa scooter at 16 before anybody even knew what a Vespa scooter was in Canada, of all places. We'll put that aside. So I did already kind of have that kind of power to do what I wanted, in a sense. I drive it into Vaughan Road and park it like on the walkway into the front entrance. I just park it there, throw it on the kickstand, and it was like very cool. However, nobody thought it was a cool vehicle other than me. So, but I still really enjoyed it. We only got rid of it a couple of years ago because I hadn't used it. And let's leave that for now. But
that's a whole other story.
Yeah, it's another rabbit hole to fall into, perhaps. So the car thing is a very important thing, and my brother actually was instrumental in getting me a car. It was $200. It was a 1979 Oldsmobile Cutlass, and it was his neighbor's car, an Indian family that were trading it in or getting rid of it, and he arranged for me to buy it. And it always became my mom paid for it, per se. And it was my mom bought me a car. So my dad bought me the Vespa. No, actually, I think I had accumulated enough money. It was under $3,000 back then for this brand new Vespa. Or maybe under $2,000, $1,900. Not sure. But it doesn't matter. I think I had accumulated some money. But my mother used to take the Canada baby bonus and put it into a special account. So somehow I thought I had money, but really it wasn't really my money. That money was to feed me, I guess. I don't know why they gave this bonus, but it was pretty cool. It turned into my Vespa, per se. And then I got the Cutlass, and that was, you know, fantastic. Now you can go drive in the rain, you can take people along and so forth. And
that was great until you crashed it.
Well, I mean, crashed it. I think it was just mindlessness that I had two girls in the front seat with me, friends from before. And yeah, there was a bit of interest, but we were driving down Allen Expressway approaching Eglinton. And to this day, I believe that that is a nasty kind of collection of cars. You know, people stop and then all of a sudden, oh my God, everyone stopped. I'm not sure if
there
was a
kind of, you always have to be very,
there was a bit of a blind kind of curve getting to see the exit, and then the cars accumulated back. But anyway, this was a nighttime and I'm going down, and I couldn't stop in time because we were looking for a lighter to light a cigarette that we had been passed around in the front seat. Everyone had a cigarette and we were going to light it. When you were looking for a lighter and it fell on the floor, and I think I lost my focus and that at the very wrong time. And by the time I hit the brakes, it was imminent that I was going to hit. And so that was unfortunate. But then, you know, with my challenges of figuring out what my calling was going to be, let's say, to participate in society, all the various initiatives I just bailed on after losing interest. And after I finally finished my program and hooked into an actual, job situation afterwards, I guess I lobbied again with my dad to as my brother probably did. I may have had some money or maybe not, doesn't matter. I think he paid for the school too, even though I got student loans. Yeah, I pushed the envelope, a bit reckless. That's kind of my way, unfortunately. But yeah, so he helped me actually buy, or I think my siblings are still very envious, jealous, or resentful of this, but it was under 20 grand, I believe, 19.5, got the Honda Prelude.
Oh, I thought it was 16.5.
No, the Honda Prelude started at that, but of course I had to get the top of the line. I think it was the SI, yeah.
Yeah, that was a cool sunroof. I really like
the sunroof. Yeah, with the sunroof, it was black on black,
And the velvet upholstery inside I thought was quite luxurious. And I liked your dash because it was the first dash that I had seen where you can actually put something on it.
Yeah, it had these little cutout things where stuff wouldn't just fall off. Yeah. Coins wouldn't come out of it.
So is that why when you bought the Impreza here, you wanted Zevin's name on it? Was that your thinking of, well, you know, a guy's got to have your name on a car or have a car or whatever. Is that why you were thinking?
Well, I don't think there's a good reason. I just figured, why not? Anyway, yeah. So let me try and bring this back to point. I think I threw out the I word again, and that's integrity. And yeah, I made that decision to try and help Sunset, you know, fixer, me, being confronted with a problem. My dad wasn't necessarily unhappy with the situation, but he definitely was motivated to be trying to fix something because he was presented with this problem that his income, pension, retirement, I don't know, whatever it is, we're not covering the cost of being there. And this was, you know, dished out to him or made aware to him at least. And that probably didn't need to happen. I think that should have been better resolved by the four siblings who were going to ultimately get whatever money back if we had to put back in. So it was a missed opportunity because I think I was lobbying for everybody to just, well, let's see what it takes to make it even. And once a month or so, we kind of backfill and keep dad happy. Because like you said, he wanted to go do bingo. He wanted to participate in these little things. You know how they do in these retirement home things. They have to create these events, regardless of whether it's appreciated or not. It keeps things going, different, distractive. Even if he doesn't like one particular event, there might be something else tomorrow or the next day. And
So, the decorating the Christmas tree, the accordion guy coming in and playing some songs and stuff. But it's all stuff that it's the beauty of that, in my opinion, is that when you don't want to see that nonsense, you've got a very nice, comfortable one bedroom.
Yeah, he had a fantastic suite, which I thought was ideal. It was facing in the south direction, which got a bit warm in the summertime, but windows could be opened and blinds could be shaded, and there was air conditioning and so forth. So it wasn't a, you know, climate was controllable. It's just, yeah, when you get that southern exposure and the sun beats in, it could be a little bit whatever. And that's the best time for to you know, go down to the social, go down to the, you know, the areas and do something else, right? And, you know, go get a coffee. They had a nice little coffee machine there. You could just go push the button and it happens and stuff. Whatever. But he was destined, or he was burdened with solving this problem of making ends meet. And it was not, it, that was the beginning of the end, let's say, because he one of his friends had a bachelor, which means it has no actual bedroom. It's just one space. And he went to visit him and asked him if he's comfortable and so forth and how much you pay. And there was a significant, let's say, a not insignificant difference in price. And he decided to pursue changing rooms and moving himself into a lower one to see if that would help bridge the divide. So one can even reflect on his decision to change his living environment, per se, go into a smaller room, rather than finding some alternative like going back to his existing and at the time still in ownership house. He rather, let me see if I can save some money here and if I can stay here. Like, that's the unspoken message from behavior. A lot of people say things, but not really, doesn't really reflect, you know, the full picture of what they might be trying to say or do. But when someone takes that action to move themselves from a bigger room to a smaller room, to me, it doesn't say someone is not happy staying where they are. It means, let me see what I have to do to make this work. And I remember communications between us
actually, that's a good point, because why do you say, okay, I'll just go home?
Exactly. And I tried desperately to try and get the four of us to just contribute and keep him out of the
an old person
situation.
Who worked their
because
whole
he
life
did their whole...
didn't have to worry about money, especially.
Well, regardless
he has
of should have. He's not in a position to make the best decisions at this point because he can't go work and make more money, let's say, to make his way better. He can't. It becomes tricky. So I figured it would be much better to keep him out of that whole billing thing, make that between us. And that never really happened. And so they at the suggestion of moving into a smaller unit was gleefully accepted by the people who were, you know, instrumental, my elder siblings. And so they moved him into a smaller place, and in the smaller place was facing north, which in the summer was probably fantastic, nice, cool, but in the wintertime was nasty because it cold is coming from there all the time. So you end up drying out the environment with so much heat that has to be applied. So, and he wasn't quite as happy as he thought he was going to be in that place. And of course, he needed to get moved to the other side again. And conveniently, I think another unit came up and he was moved into that. And at this point, we were still battling the income and expenses for him to remain there. So this was almost a regular topic that would come up when I'd see him. And there was a period there in between my work contracts. I believe I had a few weeks or something like that in between. And of course, I catch wind of it, and I don't have any. And at that time, I didn't have the other distraction, let's say, of work and stuff to preoccupy me. So I actually got involved, and I embraced the problem, and I started seeking solutions to give him solace in his sunset. And yeah, I came up with this thought that because we weren't long-term planning to stay in the city, we wanted to basically come up here by the lake and kind of, you know, anticipate our sun setting and not become, you know, something where you're now stuck, you know, not enjoying your life because all your health has declined at this state. We wanted to try and get to a place where we could enjoy our life a little bit more without all the major Babylon interference that happens in a bigger city. And so we had kind of brainstormed this idea that I would somehow either buy his property and, you know, pay out whatever, or we would just live there, keep it updated. We tried to figure out a way to kind of kill multiple birds with a single stone, the stone being the problem, and the problem being facilitating his best interests in a pleasant sunsetting time. So we ultimately, you know, just going to cut this kind of short, but we ultimately did embark on that. And we lived in that house, and we basically gave him the ability to come and visit when he wanted and or needed or desired, and spend some time back at where he had basically spent the bulk of his latter years, since about the late 80s, I think, is when we moved in there.
You know what? That was a lovely, lovely plan, and a very generous thing that you did when you think about it, because most old people don't want to be moved. And
absolutely,
when I think about it, that I didn't realize that, because in my opinion, there was always a way to work something out. What I didn't realize, and what this reading brings to me, ready and at home. At that time, I was not ready and at home. I got the knock at the door in the middle of the night when you're going to answer in your pajamas and you're not quite sure and you're disoriented.
Right.
Had I been ready and at home, meaning ready for the battle, not wanting a battle, but I didn't realize that a battle was being brought to us. And I didn't realize that that was going on, because I would have definitely, having understood that, would have
approached it differently.
Yes,
sure.
Well,
everything would be.
And so what the benefit I find about the Stoicism is that it does bring a certain calm. It reminds you to calm. It puts in perspective what you can control and what you can't. So we can't control them and anything that they want to do. However, can't control ours. So this actually is very great, and it brings in the integrity. I don't want a battle, but if you bring me a battle, I'm going to fight it with all my might and with my integrity intact.
Well, it's interesting you make that statement, because that never ran through my mind at all. I didn't think my intentions would be questioned. And I couldn't believe it when, you know, some of the hostilities kind of grew up, started to show themselves in this, how many years? So that was like 15, I guess. You know, both my brother and my dad passed in 2020, at the end of 2020. So really, you're only talking about 4 years of, four and a half, let's say, 4.5 to 5 years of this particular period. And for the entire period, it was one of these surreal dystopic things that I couldn't believe that I was, my intentions, I didn't even know if it was my intentions. I at the time, I just couldn't even rationalize, what exactly is all this hostility about? Don't you realize I've sacrificed my stability to embark on this, to provide a better sunset potentially for my father? And I didn't embark on it because I was selfless and just wanted to give away my life. I figured the compromise of what I was giving up in this, you know, very well appointed. And sure, there were challenges with it, but which house doesn't have challenges? A leaky front cover roof is not a reason to sell your house. It wasn't leaking in the front. It was the overhang over the front door. Yes, it was a pain in the butt. It upset me, but that's definitely not a reason to sell your house and go live in compromise environment. Or even if there was no hostility, there's no, that's not a good enough reason
see,
to
you
do
are
that.
Coming from a mental space of caring and giving. It's kind of like when you go to Jamaica and you go into the wrong neighborhood and you get the major hustle. If you don't understand where you're, the environment you're walking into,
yeah, true.
You're going to get hustled and you can't even predict it because that's not your environment. You have no skills on how to deal with that environment.
Yeah, well, you know, obviously, if you don't properly know your environment, if you take for granted, which is what I'm trying to say as the youngest, raised by these siblings and my parents, of course, because we, you know, 10 years plus division and also, you know, coming to this land as 2 years old as opposed to 10 to 16, 17 is a big difference, right? So, it's almost a generational gap-ish from that standpoint. You know, these people all kind of hit puberty before they came, except maybe my youngest sister, who I was actually closest with from a connection basis. Anyway, I wouldn't have ever expected that what I was doing would be perceived as a selfish thing. And it was just very difficult for me to reconcile this, and it was a battle. And I would have never chosen to enter a battle as such for material gain. Forget about it. That was never on the barometer. Of course, it would serve me well. We wanted to stay a few more years in town and then ultimately move up here. We figured the timing was a good time. So, and this opportunity comes up. It's almost like it seemed like a perfect path to everyone being happy. It would alleviate a lot of stress because, hey, my dad did spend 2.5 or almost 3 years living with us collaboratively with all of the hired help and so forth, because I wasn't allowed to actually make choices. It was very tricky to communicate with these people. They almost went out of their way to not communicate with me and avoid it. Very much like they're all their offspring and, you know, my sister who is still alive do. They all rather close off communications than try and have a tricky exchange. So that battle was definitely not something I would look forward to, wouldn't choose. And there were several opportunities to get out of that battle. You know, I could have easily just, hey, you know what? Buy another house, get the hell out of here. And we explored that. We got the signing and we ended up canceling it because something inside of me told me this is running away from something. If I run away from this, what's the next thing I'm going to run away from? Am I being self-serving to run away, or am I actually serving the greater good to run away? And we toyed with this. We toyed with the buy a couple times we were going to buy. And I believe we really pushed the renting. Let's just move on and, you know, stay here a few more years by renting in town. And, you know, we looked at some options that were close by, and it just seemed bizarrely insane to actually do that and run away or give up or whatever it may be. Somehow I just felt like I was compromised whether I did something or whether I didn't do something to the situation. It was a very conflicting situation to resolve. I had night sweats. It was definitely a horrendous 3 years, and it really alienated the family. But I tried.
3 years,
to,
5.5 years.
I mean, the first parts, it was really hard. And then I started to realize that there was some futility in this endeavor. So the integrity part I'm talking about, I didn't choose that battle. I definitely wouldn't want that battle. But that battle became before me. And now I was faced with how would my father deal with this? And there are stories of how he dealt with his siblings at the time when his parents were reaching that. And ultimately, at the end of that story, there were always grumblings. And my dad said that he actually paid out way more than for the time than was necessary, because my grandfather had these grandeur things and he, you know, it was all an image.
I recall your mom saying that, and yeah, that your Aunt Maria grumbled and thought that he ripped her off because the house went up in value. Years later, she said he ripped her off.
Right, exactly. Meanwhile, they had the money in the pocket the whole time and no worry about it. So really, this almost seems like the exact same scenario just translated into modern terms, exposed itself or presented itself. And, you know, at the end, I'm not happy to have gone through that, but I think I feel I maintained my integrity because I haven't really changed.
Sure, they brought you a war. So you didn't want a war, but they brought you a war, and you navigated that war with integrity. And
sure, that's the best way to sum it up. I didn't do the best job because obviously it could have been better ways to handle it. And today I might have approached it slightly differently or dealt with things slightly differently. And you know, to a point, with all of the post executorship that's gone on with both of their estates, which aren't completely resolved now, 4 years coming, 3.5 years later, I'm still maintaining the integrity of the point. So the battle isn't completely done, but I think I vindicated myself in the sense of, or let's just say, I've appeased my own sensibilities on what's gone down because I'd never really done anything spiteful or personally directed. But I do defend my integrity, my honor, my morals, my opinion. And if people don't have enough insight or, you know, care to exchange thoughts and ideas and potentially see that beautiful flower from a different angle where the sun really exploits the beauty in it, they're stuck looking at a dead rose. Or a dying
those waves
rose
out there.
Yeah, actually,
see where the sun is beaming and it looks like it's the Caribbean, and then you come where there's no sun and it looks like a muddy creek.
Absolutely. And so nobody actually wanted to come to the window and see what I was seeing. But I've maintained my integrity. And at the end of the discussion and all of this, when all the dust settles eventually, which it will, I don't necessarily miss the interactions with people who aren't authentically sharing. And it seems like they've all come from protective, egoist upbringings. I don't know how I escaped that, but, you know, they say when there isn't a two-way relationship, there's no relationship.
Oh, that's right.
So I don't think I missed something I never had. I kind of saddened that I was delusional to believe so much, but at the end of the day, I my stubbornness kept me to try and regain communications with all the stuff that's happened. Maybe only you know how it's impacted me. I'm still very receptive to have a sit down and a discussion with people who were basically the opposition in this war that was brought to my attention. This is huge. You read through it and gloss over it, but to me, it just talks about, you know, integrity means you deal with what comes your way. Integrity doesn't mean you avoid everything. I think I've grown a lot. And if I can at least that snippet at some point in time, maybe after all of the heat kind of calms, I hope my boys can see my actions and perhaps fuel their stubbornness to maintain integrity and some morals, which hopefully we've also helped.
Yeah, and their need to stay together as brothers and work to understand each other and support each other. And you know what, Rock? You know, good news. With your kidney function improved, that's pretty awesome. You've been through a lot of battle, and you've your quest to constantly improve things. I haven't heard anything other than that video about the guy who improved his kidney function where he was off dialysis, and you've improved yours. So good on you.
Well, I went from a 50, just over 50% filtration to well into the normal. My doctor isn't concerned. And that's all about getting rid of, I think the biggest part, I don't want to push exactly what I do, but I think the very biggest part of health is to try and avoid putting consciously, knowingly, putting toxins in your body, because I think your body is perfect and it can deal with a lot. But if you overfill its capacity, it's going to flow over and start manifesting in illnesses.
Ironically, you started really onto something in 2015, 2016 is when you really started to understand and take a whole new path in health. And that's also when all of this went down. There's a correlation. I think eliminating all the garbage food from your diet has really helped you survive this war that we went through. And I don't know if maybe you would have made it through all the stress with a garbage diet. So, you know, it was a trial and error with keto, vegan, and all of that. But I think that your these past couple years when you pretty much converted, I think that is showing results in that, your kidney function and in now processing what the heck happened and moving forward.
Yeah. So yeah, thanks for that point, because you know what, if I hadn't hit bottom enduring this war has brought to me, sleeping in the basement, sweating, having to wear a bathrobe to bed to collect the sweat that would happen and things like that, and pushed to that degree of
psyop.
Pushed to that degree of trying to keep things going, forced me to survive through that. So that personal war was probably even more pertinent to my recovery in seeing the light. Had that been easy street, I don't think I would have been trying to figure out how to health. Well, I've always been looking for health improvements, but I wouldn't have been constrained to deal with that war. So there's almost two wars that went down there: the war against these concepts and ideas, and then the war against myself. Because if it was easy street, I may not have tried to look for things for help, because it was okay. I wasn't feeling the stress, which really weighed down all the toxins I was carrying. So, you know, it's horrible to say, but that battle brought me where I am today as far as my recovery. And not to say that it couldn't have happened.
That's
it could have been a longer path, but maybe in that longer path, you know, pushed into an envelope of in your own head, I may have resorted to more dangerous self-medication tactics, which could have left me, you know, if alcohol was my mode of dealing with things. If alcohol was my mode of dealing with these things, I don't think I would have lasted because I overdo everything. So it could have, maybe that had to happen because I wouldn't have caught it in time and it would have been done by then. Who knows, right?
That's how the Stoics would look at something like that. They embrace their fortune just as or their misfortune just as much as their fortune. Neither is good or bad. It's what happens, and they embrace that. And to quote Maestro Angelo, he always said, "Va sempre dritto che arrivi." Mm-hmm. So there you go.
Yeah, that's the directions in Italy usually. So all of these battles that came my way, I wouldn't have chose, but they came my way for a reason. And I managed to utilize and make the best of that situation and ride that wave without distraction, per se. And it was a big cost for my kids, I'm learning today, and for you, of course, the whole time, but you keep it cool most of the time. And, you know, I do hear about it in retrospect. You do like to go backwards and reflect on things, but you can see now how pointless it is to go look at little details there. But this is taking you to a place where you're still alive. I could have maybe given up at some point or killed myself because of the abusing of things to try and tolerate or to, you know, to be able to endure what I was experiencing. So this is huge. This is it's very important to take challenges voluntarily, not that you're looking for. Let me go find a rock I can climb up. No, it's not about that. If you find yourself in a hole and all you got to do is climb out, hey, now you got that motivation to actually decide what you're going to do and then do it, like actually follow through. So maybe the message on this is follow through on what you embark on. Don't give up. Don't give up and make sure you thought it through well. Either way, you will get to the other side, dead or alive. And regardless of how you get to what shape you're in at the other side, you definitely have elevated yourself with that experience in behind.
All right.
Well, it looked like we had nothing to say about this quote today, ready and at home for March 20th, but it turns out we've got our longest talk ever on
that
this.
That was the lovely coffee.
Well, let's hope made sense and can apply some wisdom to the rest of the world in a positive sense that just hang in there. Just hang in there. Things will get better if you aren't doing things in an egoist way, at the end of it, you'll be free. You'll be free and hopefully regret free too. On that, I think we might have a second cup today. Blessings. And that's it for now.
Bless up.
Oh boy, that was a marathon. You probably need a couple drinks after listening through that. Well, I hope you found it interesting, intriguing, or entertaining. Let us know. And till tomorrow, have a stoic day.